Quick announcement. Did you know that we have an ADHD Mums shop filled with resources designed just for you? These resources are packed with answers to the most frequently asked questions I get sent in via email. Everything from understanding ADHD and autism to practical tips for daily life. There's also a free assessment tool. If you're wondering about ADHD or autism for yourself or your little one, don't forget to check out the free assessment tool under free resources section on my website, adhdmums.com.au. This tool is specifically designed to help you access practitioners who truly understand masking and camouflaging, ensuring that you get value for your money after the long wait times and investment involved in assessments. So go over to the website, grab a resource, and support your journey. Hello and welcome to ADHD Mums. In this podcast, we tackle the tough, often unspoken realities of motherhood, neurodiversity, and mental health. This is where we deep dive into important issues that affect mums, especially those of us who are neurodivergent. I'd like to issue a trigger warning for this episode. In today's episode, we will be discussing topics on emotional abuse, bullying, coercion. These can be distressing topics, particularly for those who have experienced or witnessed similar situations. If you find any part of this episode triggering, overwhelming, please feel free to pause, take a break, seek support. All of the support services will be listed at the end. The content we are discussing today is heavy. However, it is also our responsibility to talk about it. Emotional abuse often goes unnoticed or unspoken, and that's part of the problem. I've interviewed a friend that I've known a long time on her relationship with her mother as a way of illustrating what mother-child emotional abuse looks like. The reason that I've done it is because this isn't just about highlighting a problem, it's about what we can do. And at the end of the interview, I speak to Jasmine, that's not her real name, about what we can do, what signs we can notice in our children's friends, and how we can possibly be a lifeline for one of those children if we were to identify it. And it can be very tricky. But this interview certainly got me thinking about my children's friends and what responsibility I have to really be listening and noticing. So I thank Jasmine for her bravery. Avoiding these conversations don't make the problems go away. It just silences the people who are suffering. I believe it's our responsibility as a society to acknowledge the weight of the issues, to create the space where they need to be discussed, and to offer support where we can. Yes, the content's heavy, but the lives impacted are real, and we owe it to those who are struggling to at least start the conversation. Because even if it helps just one person, that's enough. Emotional abuse is a form of manipulation and control, and it causes psychological harm, but it doesn't leave physical marks. Psychological harm can be more subtle, it can be harder to recognize in others, but its impact is just as damaging and arguably more damaging. Emotional abuse can occur in any relationship: romantic, workplace, professional, friends, siblings, any relationship. At its core, it's about maintaining power over another person. Some common examples of emotional abuse would be constant criticism, gaslighting, isolation, threats and intimidation, controlling behavior, blaming, guilting, silent treatment. Emotional abuse can leave deep scars. It can affect a person's confidence, mental health, and ability to trust others. Over time, it can lead to anxiety, depression, physical health problems, or long-term chronic stress. While it's not always visible, emotional abuse is a powerful tool of control, and it can be just as devastating as other types of abuse. Recognizing what it is the first step to break free from this type of cycle. And here's Jasmine's story. Thank you so much for being here, Jasmine. I was particularly keen to interview you because we often focus on domestic violence between men to women, and that's not always the case. So I was keen to share your story because I don't want all of the stories to be males to females when it can happen female to female as well. What is the experience that you were wanting to share?
For context, I am now in my 30s and I experienced emotional abuse throughout my childhood by my mother, but predominantly between the ages of 12 and 16. They were when it happened the most, and then into my adulthood life as well. It probably only stopped a few years ago, and that's because I had the therapy and put boundaries in place to stop it from continuing to happen. But Yeah, it was quite intensive from the age of 12 onwards, I would say, with breaks in between.
So why did it start at 12? Like, what was the factors there?
I was raised by my dad. He was a single dad in the 90s. My mum lost custody of me when I was 3, and that's because we were in a DV household with her partner at the time, and she left the state, and that was because she was losing a court case battle with my father. It started when I was 12 because that's when I moved to be with her full time.
Okay. And so initially when you were reunited with your mum, were you excited? Like, you probably romanced it, I imagine.
I was close with my maternal grandparents. They still had a lot to do with me, as did my paternal grandparents. So I was very lucky to have two sets of pretty hands-on grandparents. I spent my time between them and my dad. So I did know that I had a mum because they would talk about her. And I did talk to her over the phone, even though we weren't in the same state. I think from the ages of 8 to 12, she ended up moving back to the state and I ended up going every second weekend to see her. But what triggered it was my dad actually went to prison, not crazy offences, and he actually came out with psychosis. So I didn't have much of a choice. My grandparents did take care of me in that period of time while my dad was in prison. But when my dad got out and they realised it was going to be longer term, my grandparents just didn't have the capacity to be able to take care of me, which I do not hold against them. It is completely understandable. So I did end up moving to be with my mom and sisters.
And did they realise that you were potentially going to an emotionally abusive house?
Yes. So I had a drug and alcohol house with domestic violence or an emotionally abusive house to choose from. I think if my grandparents had have known the full extent of it and if they could turn back time, they definitely would. But I guess they didn't really know how bad it was going to be and how difficult that time was going to be for me between the ages of 12 and 16, which for a girl are just fundamental years to get wrong.
Oh, they're tricky even with a stable background. For context for everybody listening, Jasmine has given me full rein to ask what I like, so I'm probably going to ask her some invasive questions. If anyone's wondering, what is Jane doing? Leave poor Jasmine alone. She has given me full rein. I've got such a really awkward question, but I'm known for my awkward questions. Would you prefer a drug and alcohol and DV house or an emotionally abusive house if you had to pick?
Drug, alcohol and DV.
You would?
Yes.
By far or a little bit?
By far. I experienced both, and emotional abuse is the hardest because you are so alone. There are no physical signs of it. There is no escape. You're in it 24/7.
Yeah, they've done some research recently. Neglect and emotional abuse affects a child trauma-wise more than anything else. There's a bit of a cycle, but with emotional abuse, it's fairly constant. It can be really constant. Like, how did the emotional abuse kind of present?
I probably should have known that it was going to be right from the start. The way I ended up moving with my mum full-time happened quite unexpectedly. So I remember that I went to my normal fortnightly visit with my mum and she gave me a mobile phone. We were talking about, you know, back when mobile phones weren't really like a huge thing. So to be given this mobile phone, I felt pretty privileged. She knew the household that I was coming from, and I think she played that against me to really leverage that. And when I look back on it now, those fortnightly visits, even though they were short, she really worked hard to tell me my dad was a bad person, that I was unsafe, that I needed to be with her, made me feel so good, so, so good, promised me the world pretty much. So when I took that phone home and I went through a situation, what did I do? I texted my mom to let her know, because as a 12-year-old girl, I thought, I've got someone to talk to now. And then before I knew it, she was there and taking me to be with her. So I didn't even get to say a goodbye to my dad or my stepmom, and later found out police actually visited them, so he wasn't able to see me. I think from that point, I probably should have realised, but as a 12-year-old girl, I always longed to have a mom who loved me, and I was going to be with my sisters within the first probably week, all I remember is mom actually coming to me and giving me the movie Cinderella with Hilary Duff and Chad Michael Murray in it and saying, this is you now. Like, this is actually what I'm going to be. But I didn't really think of the extent of it until looking back on it now.
So you were the eldest and these are like half younger sisters, and then you are effectively cook, maid, cleaner, slave lady, slave daughter.
Yeah, it happened pretty quickly. I'd look after my sisters, clean the house, anything really that was needed, that's what I would do. And I quickly realised that there was no going back. All contact was cut off with my dad. I was told and brainwashed that he didn't want me anymore. And this was my only choice, was to stay there because my dad wasn't, one, capable and able to look after me, but two, he didn't want me. Like, who would want you after what you just did to him? You just had the police involved. And do you want everyone to know that your dad's a criminal? Do you want that? No. So this is what your life is now, and there's no choice and there's no getting out of it. So suck it up and let's move forward. So that's what I did.
So it sounds like you were very set up. Like, do you think she saw, oh, 12-year-old girl, she seems fairly compliant, she will do all the crap jobs around the house that I don't want to do? Do you think that was the thought?
Yes, that was definitely the thought. And because I had already come from a DV household, my masking and camouflaging were out of this world impressive. I was such a compliant little girl. Such a people pleaser. I wanted to please anyone around me. So she already saw those attributes in me and really took advantage of that.
So did you then, because I know that you said there was drug and alcohol and DV, but then I get an element that you really loved your dad. That would have been devastating. Like, did he show you love? Like, amongst that, did he he loved you?
He loved me unconditionally. He still does. He made mistakes, and that's something that we've both worked through. I was never physically harmed in the house. I would just awake to my stepmom and dad fighting quite violently. And that is emotional abuse in itself. And I'm not going to say that it didn't impact me, because it definitely did. But I did feel safe in my relationship with dad, and he did want the best for me.
It's interesting that you say that, because a friend of mine, her parents divorced when she was actually a very similar age. She was 13, and she had the choice whether to live with her mum or her dad. And her mum was in a very DV relationship, and she had quite a horrible partner, and he would physically assault her. And they also had addiction issues. But her dad was very cold and didn't show any love. He didn't do anything wrong, but he didn't do anything at all. And he just existed. And she chose to be with the mum and the partner because the skerricks of love were there. Is that similar?
Yeah, definitely. I think too, when I was with my dad, I had my paternal grandparents, and I'm very close with them. So I always knew that there was a safety net. Whereas at my mum's house, there was no safety net, because my grandparents on her side were very much involved in this emotional turmoil household. They'd talk about me while I was in the room, provide me like with the cold shoulder. I always just knew what I needed to do at all times to avoid getting the silent treatment, avoid feeling manipulated, and avoid feeling like I was lesser of a person, like played against my sisters, or, you know, avoid any of that. And also, strangely, avoid letting my mum down. I didn't want to upset her. I didn't want to disappoint her. I just wanted her to love me. I just always wanted her to love me. Yeah. And I still do.
Yeah. Oh, I think that's really natural. You know, children who've been taken from their parents and they go into the foster system, they still, a lot of the time, want to be reunited with their birth parents, even if the situation isn't great. And I suppose, though, you also thought that your dad was closed off to you. So you're like, well, I've already got the one option. So can you give some examples of kind of a day with Jasmine? Like, did you have to get up early and do all the cooking and cleaning? Like, did you go to school? How did it work?
So when I think back on it, it's actually quite lonely and cold, really. And I also feel like I just body doubled with my mum at all times. So I was her body double. And to be honest, I think that was her way of coping as well through life. I think she really relied on me heavily. But I would wake up. I didn't have my own bedroom a lot of the time. And a lot of the time I would actually have to share a bed with my mom. So that's a whole other element of the story. But yeah, I would wake up and I would get myself ready for school and my sisters ready for school, whether that was breakfast, getting dressed, and just really staying out of mom's way, to be honest. Mornings were pretty good though, because she did want us to go to school happy. And I think that was actually genuine. I think she actually wanted us to do well in school. So she would never do anything really to us of a morning because, one, she didn't want us to go and talk at school. And two, she wanted to set us up that we were going to have a great day and then we're going to come home and it's going to be all fantastic. So mornings weren't so bad.
How many sisters do you have?
I have two.
Okay, so you go off to school and then, you know, apparently it's all happy, happy, and possibly your mum believed that. And then you come home and how does that go?
I would read her mood quite quickly. So if she was happy, I would make sure that no matter what day I had at school, I would be happy. So if I had a terrible day at school, there was no room for me to even talk about that because I would never want to upset mum's happy mood. If it was the other way around and her mood was quite on edge, she was cranky, then I would step on eggshells. And when I say walk on eggshells, I don't mean walk on eggshells to stay out of her way. I mean walk on eggshells so she knows that I'm walking on eggshells. So she can see that I can see that she's upset and I'm doing everything possible. Like it wasn't like a, I'm going to stay out of your way. It was like a, I'm going to stay out of your way, but you know that I'm staying out of your way. So I'm doing what you need me to do. So I'm good.
Sounds really hypervigilant. Like I'm acknowledging how stressed out you are. So I'm going to behave like you are the most stressed out person in the world. So then you know that I know and you don't have to show me that you're upset. And what about your sisters? What did they have the same thing or not?
Yes. So my sisters experienced it far worse than me because they actually had emotional abuse and physical abuse. So she would actually physically abuse them. And that was really, really hard for me to watch. There was the period there where she used to make me physically abuse them. So that's something. We know that that's the situation between us three sisters, but we never explicitly talk about it. Because it's just too much. It's just too much. And they still have a close relationship with mum. I quickly learned if I was in the firing line, they would be protected. So as I got older, more so towards the 16 and onwards, even now, if I'm the one that's excluded or if I'm the one that's given the cold shoulder, they're going to be okay and they're going to be treated better because there always is just one in the firing line. So I quickly learned if I put myself in that firing line, they would be safe.
Oh, that's I'm trying not to make it about me. That was really heavy. Hey, I wasn't expecting you to say that, to be honest.
It is really fucked up. And to be honest, I don't think it is until I talk about it that I'm like, oh, that is actually really fucked up.
It's really fucked up. So did your sisters then play this game like, I know that you're upset, so I'm going to be the good girl? Or did they act out and then your mum would be angry? Is that how it happened?
Yeah. So I'm an internalizer. My sisters are externalizers. The younger one is more so a bit of a combination. But yeah, that was the difference.
So was it like, can you be like Jasmine, please? Why are you crying and stuff? Jasmine's quiet and doing what I'm asking. So yes. Then it would be like an us against them thing, wouldn't it?
Yes. And that has carried right through into adulthood. Even up until a few years ago, it was always talking about the other with the other. And if a relationship was starting to form too closely between two of us, then that would be squashed. No, we don't like Jasmine. So remember, we're going to exclude Jasmine now for about a year or two, then we'll bring Jasmine back into our lives.
So it's exclusion, manipulation. Yeah, like I suppose they say there's nothing that unites a team more than a common enemy. So if she wants to get in tight with you, she's got to section someone else off. So it sounds like for me I would want to run. Did you ever think about leaving?
Yes. I used to dream about it. And I think that was actually my biggest coping mechanism was thinking about when I get out, this is going to be so much better. I got really excited. One day I got this invite in the mail and it was to my uncle's wedding, my dad's brother. And I thought, this is going to be fantastic. I'm going to be able to go to the wedding. For context, I was by this stage probably 14, 15, and I had seen my dad once or twice. I missed him so much. So when I got this invite, it was like a no-brainer. I have to go. I have to see dad's side of the family, and I'm going to be able to talk to them, and I'm going to be able to just have an out. And that did not eventuate.
You're not allowed to go?
I was not allowed to go. My mum told me that I wouldn't want to go there. There would be alcohol involved. They wouldn't even want me there. So it was just a formal thing that they had to do, but I wasn't able to go. But at that point, I thought, I want to get out of this. So a couple of times I ran away to my friend's house, but that was no good because my friend's mum would just call up my mum and say, you know, Jasmine's here and come and get her.
How did your mum present to another mother? Like totally normal or?
Very, very good at it. She is so good at presenting to the world as a really good person. If you passed her on the street, had a conversation with her, you would just love her. You would say, wow, she is so nice. She's kind. I want to be friends with her.
It's a terrifying thought.
It is so terrifying. So, yeah, that's how she presented to my friends as a really beautiful person. But I could never go to friends' parties, friends' houses. I could only go to school. And I was just shit scared to talk to anyone about anything. And when my friends would complain about their parents, I would just be like, oh, wow, maybe they're going through something similar and this is normal. I think because everyone thought that my mum was amazing, I just thought, well, she's amazing.
Like you're the problem.
Yeah. But I did escape when I was 16. And thinking about it, I thought I escaped, but mum set it up for me to leave. She'd had enough of me by then. I was all used up. I'd been the live-in babysitter for 4 years. I'd cleaned the house. I had done everything for her, pretty much raised my sisters for that period of time. And she thought, I'm ready to live my dream life now with my new boyfriend and my two daughters. I don't need this daughter in my home anymore. So we went for a trip away and it was about 2.5 hour drive. And I just remember feeling this sense of discomfort. And because I was so aware of everything, all moods, I could just feel this mood shift. And that whole weekend, I was made to feel like we don't want you here. Anything I did, breathing would just cause an uproar. And I caught the bus to school the next day. And I remember going to school and the whole time I was watching the clock because I thought, when that clock hits 3:15, I'm getting on the bus to my dad's house. I'm doing it. I'm just going to do it. And I did. I did it. I got on the bus and I went to my dad's house and I just told him absolutely everything.
What was his reaction when you walked in? Because he hadn't seen you for 4 years.
I should say that probably about 6 months prior, I did try to leave and I contacted my dad and we had arranged for him to come to the school. Oh, this is actually really sad. We had arranged for him to come to the school and take me, but he turned up drunk. So I was so close to getting out.
And were you so excited and then you saw him?
And because he turned up to the school drunk, my mum was called.
Oh, and she's like the angel light lady that's so amazing. Saving you from your father, that was actually your preference.
So he just really sealed the deal and just made mum's story so much in concrete.
Do you think it was pressure? Like that just, it was too much pressure and he just thought, I'll just have a few drinks and then he just went too far. Not to minimise it, but I'm just saying like, why would he do that? That's so frustrating.
Yes, definitely. And I feel so terrible for him because I think if he could turn back time, he would definitely not turn up to the school drunk to get me. So he did know vaguely what was going on, but not to the extent of it. And to be honest, I was told that it was best for me just to keep going. But after that holiday, I thought, that's it, I'm getting out. And so I did. And my mom said, come and get all your stuff by Sunday, otherwise I'm taking it all to the tip. But when I got up there to pick up all the stuff, that's when I walked into the house and she said, you come here and tell your sisters that you're breaking their heart, that you're leaving them, that this is all on you. You don't want to live with them anymore. You don't want to be their sisters anymore. And it wasn't until about a year ago that one of my sisters and I actually reformed our relationship, and now we've got a really healthy relationship. And that's probably because she's in therapy now for the first time too, and seeing it for what it is.
How bad was this?
An example that a lot of children experience is being told to sit at the table until they finish their tea. We know that's common, particularly in millennials looking back on their childhood. Mine would go even further than that. So I would have to sit and eat my tea and vomit in my mouth, or go and vomit in the toilet, come back and keep going with my meal, because that's a meal that my mum cooked. And I would be told that I am being ridiculous, I am being selfish, I am stupid for vomiting, and that I'm just drawing attention to myself. And don't be so ridiculous. Just get over it. Just eat your tea and get over it.
Wow. Is that the same rule for everybody? Like, are these examples what went through with the sisters as well, or did they get a free pass and it was just you?
I don't know. And I can't remember if they went through it too, but I feel like this would have been my punishment. We all have different fathers. My younger one, her father died, and the middle one, her father, she doesn't even know who that is. And my mom's never allowed that to be a thing. So there was no out for them. There was an out for me. So mum always had to be mindful of that, even though she emotionally abused me so much, so to make me feel like there wasn't an out. Essentially, there was still an out.
And she could probably tell that you actually really loved your dad.
Yes. Yeah. And during that period of time, she tried to break it, but if anything, it probably just made us stronger. Another example is Christmases and birthdays. So I would get a gift, as would my sisters. My gift probably wouldn't be as good as theirs because they were younger and I had to understand that. But my gift would be conditional. You get this camera because you've been really good. You've been such a good girl to me, and you've done what I've said. You've listened to me. That's the only reason why you get it. You wouldn't have got the gift otherwise. You wouldn't have got it. So I always thought gifts are conditional.
And love is conditional.
So whenever I'd get excited about a new friend, she'd always tell me that they didn't like me. And I wasn't worthy of friendships, or like it was always about them, or they're not a good person. And she always told me through my teenage years that I was being bullied. But looking back on it, I was never bullied. So when I was 16 and she had her new boyfriend, this was when she was starting to prepare me to get out. And looking back on it now, I realized that. But I remember going to sleep, and I actually had my own room because she had a boyfriend, so I didn't have to sleep in the same bed as her anymore, which was just unreal. I thought, this is absolutely amazing. So I had my own bed and I was laying down to go to sleep for the night, and then all of a sudden I was woken up to the light switch being turned on and mom standing at the door, and she said, right, it's time for you to be honest with me. And I was like, about what? And she said, you've been sleeping with my boyfriend.
Oh, no.
And I was like, sorry. And I sort of laughed. I was like, ha, ha, ha. Like, this is so funny.
Like, it's laughable because it was so ridiculous. Was like, yeah.
And then she's like, just know I've got my eye on you. And I know that you've been sleeping with him and it's going to end. So. Yeah, that was fucked.
I did wonder that, if whether she got rid of you because you were 16 and you were like a threat because you were younger and.
Yeah, you know. And I was beautiful. I was a beautiful 16-year-old.
What about the teachers at school? Like, do you think that there was warning signs there? Like, did anyone ever ask you if you're okay? How did that work?
There were so many warning signs that they should have picked up on, because I was showing all of the typical signs of a person being abused at home, and not one teacher explicitly helped me. But I think they did have their ways of trying. But I went to school to study. School was my out. I learned from a young age that that was my safe space from kinder all the way through. But I would write in my school books about what was happening and nobody did anything about it. Nobody. And looking back on that now, I was really let down.
As mums on this podcast listening, what signs should we look for that we could possibly help someone else?
Like the quiet child, or the child who very much wants to please. Like, you can just tell they're withdrawn, or they don't seem happy if I pick up. They really just go through the motions. And to be honest, also children who attach themselves to you quite quickly as well. So if you've got any of your child's friends coming over for play dates and they really look to you to be that mother figure while they're staying with you, or they're just so impressed that you're making them food.
I don't actually imagine you being at someone else's house very often.
Yeah, I was rarely allowed at people's houses. So that's another sign if you're always getting decline. So if you do see a quiet kid, send them an invitation to come over for the house. And if they decline it multiple times, then you know that they're not wanting to provide that child with space.
Yeah, especially if you are offering to pick up and drop off. You know, if you're like making it super convenient, like I'm going to pick up and drop off. You don't have to return the favor. I'm just wanting to have your child over, and they're still declining, and you're flexible with what day. That it's a good point.
I think, and I know this puts a lot of pressure on the teachers, but I think really the teachers are the ones that are going to pick up on it most, because they've got 20 something students in their class. Like, they're going to see some different traits. Normally though, you'll find that the children, for me particularly, it's internalizing.
I would imagine that in a teacher's and a parent's mind, my idea of an abusive mother or father would look like this. Your mum comes traipsing in to pick up, or to the parent teacher or whatever it is they ring her, seemingly like a lovely person, and you're showing very subtle signs. And then what if they report it and then it's not true? Like, do you think that that goes through the mind of the teacher and the other parents?
Definitely. My mum could gaslight any situation that she needs to. And also, she is so smart. She's actually very intelligent. So she knows exactly what people want to hear.
Oh, no, those people are intelligent.
She's super manipulative.
What about this? Let's just say I have 13-year-old Jasmine at my house, or you're alone with a teacher. If you were probed, do you think you would have opened up?
No.
Have worked to get you out?
Looking back on it, it is quite hard, because there really isn't an out. If I went to talk to a teacher, I know that they would talk to my mom. So I feel like if you could go to an adult, and I'm talking about a 13-year-old going to an adult or older, so they've got the capacity to go and have a chat. If they went and spoke to a teacher and said, can we come up with a plan that I'm happy with before we bring anyone else in, or there's like a safe person. There were counselors at the school, but I couldn't go and talk to them because they were going to talk to my mom. I think there needs to be some work done there, particularly because the statistics of emotional abuse are so high in children, not the amount of children that go through it, but if you have a look at the stats, it's actually the highest form of abuse that children who are suffering from abuse experience. I think it's like 38% of children who are being abused are being emotionally abused. And it is just so terrifying, because you cannot see from the outside looking in that there is a problem. And like I said at the start of the episode, you're living in it 24/7. You're so, so scared of doing something wrong, of stepping the wrong way, breathing the wrong way, doing the wrong thing to upset that parent and trigger a response.
But then if that's the highest form of abuse and people don't know that they're in it necessarily until they're older, or they reflect back as an adult, then that would also be really underreported, which is even more terrifying.
It is. Mine would have gone unreported.
It's unreported really, isn't it? Like, where did you report it? You wouldn't even be in the stats.
No, I'm not. I'm not in the stats. And it would be the same for so many people, so many women. Maybe like education on healthy relationships for children and what these look like. Because I didn't really get to go into other people's homes, I didn't actually get to see what unconditional love looked like until I was with my partner. If I had have seen that as a child, then I would have been able to see the signs of what a healthy relationship is and what a normal house should look like. I didn't know that when people were complaining about their parents, that didn't mean that they were forced to physically abuse their siblings, forced to make cups of tea, scrub the floor, do all of that, forced to just move and breathe in a certain way to avoid being given the silent treatment for, you know, ages on end. I feel like I would have known. So maybe some education around what healthy households and relationships look like, which I know is completely hard because there is no normal house, but there should be some sort of education.
Yeah, I agree. So then if you look at trauma and abusive relationships as a child, it can be a real indicator that they're going to then go into an abusive relationship. How did you go meeting your current partner? Because it sounds like you guys have been together for a long time. You met him early. Like, how did you actually attract him?
My first proper relationship was very abusive. It was very, very turbulent. I was with this person for about a year, and it was emotional abuse as well, like sexual favors to make sure that I was making him happy and then he would spend money on me. Like, it wasn't ideal, but I thought that was normal. And I also really pushed the boundaries in that relationship as well. I wasn't the best version of myself in that relationship. So I definitely have experience where I come out and tried a relationship first and it failed. I knew after that relationship I wanted something different. And then when I came across my now partner, I still don't feel worthy of his love. And that's one of the reasons why we're not married, because I don't want to change anything about who we are and what we are, because it is so good. And I always get fearful if I have that wife label, what does that mean? Even though it doesn't mean anything, I still hold these preconceptions of what a relationship will turn out to be if I do change anything about it. It's got to be the same every day.
It's like touching wood, you know what I mean? Like, you're like, how did I get so lucky? And you're like, I don't want to get married because something might change.
Yeah. He is great though. And his family are really great too. I think one of the biggest challenges we've had though is we are parents now, and his parenting style is a little bit different to my parenting style. So that can sometimes be triggering for me. For example, if our child will make a mess in the lounge room, he'll tell the child that they're very messy and they need to clean it up. And it will be quite an aggressive way to tell them. I will say, let's just take a step back and actually just help them clean and just be a little bit kinder about things. Let them be a child, because I know I wasn't allowed to have that space to be a child. So anything that I can do for them to help, yeah, would be really good. I had postnatal depression when I had my child, and I did try and let my mum back in my life. And I was probably about 4 or 5 months in. Oh, this is adult life too. So she had purchased a house 16 seconds away from my house when I purchased.
Oh, God.
In my adult life. So she walked down 16 seconds and came on into the house, and she could see that I wasn't well. And I said, I have postnatal depression. I'm doing this, and this, and on these medications to help me. And she said, oh, I know what it's like. I actually wanted to smother you as a baby. And then I was just like, oh my goodness, that's not how I feel. And I just went into full spiral mode because I was already not in a good place. And then I said to her, can you please leave? And then she went outside and started yelling at me and saying that she never wanted to see me again. And I'm in this state with this baby. And I remember from that moment on, I'm going to be the best mum I can be to this child.
I mean, considering you haven't had the best role modeling, how were you feeling about having a family? Was that something you wanted?
We had planned for our child, but beforehand, I didn't want any children. So when I met my partner, I let him know quite early on that I didn't want any children, and if that was going to be an issue, to leave. But at 24, we were told that I potentially couldn't have children if we didn't try. I was petrified, but that's when I started therapy. and I knew what not to do. So that was probably enough for me to know what I didn't want to be and what I didn't want to do. But my partner's mom gave me the three best pieces of parenting advice I've ever been given, and I hold on to those. Do you want me to share them?
I was like, oh, give it to me. I love that.
I think you already know these, but these have been my saving grace. She said, don't worry about parenting books or what anyone else says. Just parent the way your child needs you to parent, and that's going to be different each and every day. And that has helped me so much. If I want to rock him to sleep, I can. If I want to feed him certain foods, I can, because that's what he needs, and just mold myself to him. The second thing, if you say no to your child, always tell them why so they can understand why it's a no. And the third thing is, but if you can avoid saying no, provide a choice for them so they choose one of two options. Would you like to do X or X first? Would you like to have X or X for dinner? And to be honest, those three tips have helped me in more ways than I can ever, ever imagine that they would have. And I'm so grateful all the time.
How does a grandma have that level of wisdom? Because I feel like those three tips are like what parenting experts say now with this new version of parenting that's coming through, which I think is new and evolved and great. But how has she got that back then? Well, thank you so much. This has been a real eye-opener and a little shocking, but I think we all have a responsibility to check on other children. And I think even what you said about school being a safe place, when there's school holidays and we're having play dates, there's things to look for and there's things we can ask. And I think that's really important to look at the different ways it shows up, instead of avoiding and being like, oh, I don't want to say anything, it's not my business. Well, it is our business. It's our responsibility.
I agree. And I think it's too about being realistic. To be honest, people in these situations probably aren't going to be able to leave, or they're not going to be able to leave easily. So if schools, like even if teachers can know that something's up, they can at least provide some sort of coping mechanisms to help them through. For example, visualizing what it will look like, providing them with hope that there's an out, and just having someone that they can actually trust and talk to. I think that would actually be pretty good.
Yeah, or like an outlet, you know, you can come to my house once a week and maybe that's your happy time for the whole week, but that may mean a lot. And you're right, you know, like the chances of it going to family court and then like getting the custody removed, maybe that's not in the realms of possibility, but maybe you can provide a little sense of happiness to a child, because that's going to mean a lot.
Yeah, I think if I had have had more happiness in those years, it would have made it a little bit more bearable.
Thanks for sharing, Jasmine. It was an incredibly brave thing to do. So to pick up from where we left off at the end, Jasmine was talking about how difficult it would have been for the teachers or other parents to identify what was going on in her home because of the way her mother presented and how silent it was. With such a lack of evidence, it's difficult to prove. And as such a young child, that person is your whole world and they are determining your life every day, which is one of the reasons why I believe that people that are being abused are not speaking out. So if we look at warning signs to the type of abuse, with emotional abuse, if we were looking at children, a child may seem unusually quiet, withdrawn, or afraid of doing something wrong. They may present overly critical of themselves. Emotional abuse can cause children to have low self-esteem and a sense of worthlessness. Inappropriate emotional reactions. A child might show extreme emotional responses like frequent crying or anger that seems way out of proportion to the situation. Or they might be the opposite, where they don't show emotion. They come across unaffected by things that another child would have a fairly standard reaction to. They may also struggle to develop relationships, friendships, or express appropriate emotions for their age. It may be difficult to get that child to your home if they are in an emotionally abusive household. There is a large level of control coming from the perpetrator. Jasmine also talked about hearing stories about her friends' parents and their teenage discussions on their parents. But when she went to someone's house, which wasn't very frequently, she was really taken aback that, you know, the parents were providing food and washing sheets and doing a lot of these things for their child. They may show surprise at seeing some of the things that goes on. And it's always a good idea to ask questions and notice these things. And these are just like signs of little things that we can look for. And even if every single one of those was there, that doesn't necessarily equal emotional abuse. But it's always, in my mind, better to report than to not report if you are unsure. The child may also be unusually attached to a caregiver or fearful of being left alone with that caregiver. This child may be acting out violently with peers, becoming a bully, mimicking behaviors they've experienced at home, or they could be the other way, completely people-pleasing, terrified of doing the wrong thing, and internalizing everything that's going on around them and not wanting to impact anybody at all or ask for anything. You may notice a child talking about or attempting to run away frequently or talking about living elsewhere. Again, none of these are definites. These are just signs and things to watch out for if you are unsure. It can be very tricky to identify, and I don't pretend to know all the answers. I'm just trying to provide some things to think about. If you did feel like possibly a child was being abused and you were confused what to do, firstly, you would want to create a safe space and try and attempt to get that child to open up to you. Listen without judgment and offer support, but don't pressure them for details and let them know they're safe, believed. You can also keep a record of what you see, including dates, physical signs, changes in behavior. Sometimes it can be of a pattern over a long period of time, but it's difficult later on, if you've been noticing over 6 months, to really remember the dates and times and have a record of this. I think documenting and keeping a record is really important. And obviously, contact Child Protective Services, a school counselor or police if you were to suspect abuse. You can remain anonymous in most cases. It's better to report and be wrong than to remain silent when a child may be at risk. Recognizing the signs of abuse in children is essential to protecting them and ensuring their safety. Children often lack the ability or the confidence to speak up about abuse. So it's up to the adults to notice the warning signs and take appropriate action. By being vigilant and supportive member of your community, you can help a child in need. We all hope that this isn't happening in our community. However, we have a responsibility to keep our eyes and ears open for those children that are defenseless in this. This is a really difficult topic to bring up. I haven't experienced this myself. I'm very aware that I haven't covered everything and I can't cover everything, but I'm attempting to shed light on the difficult topics, and that is going to be what makes a big difference, I hope. If this mini series and if this episode helps one person identify someone or identify a child in their network, in their community that needs help, and it helps put some of that together, then it would have been worth it. Thank you so much for listening and sticking with me. This has been a really tricky topic, and I really want to acknowledge everybody who's sat with the heaviness, because it's these conversations that make all the difference. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time.
The key message here is you are not alone. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, follow us on Instagram or head over and join our amazing ADHD Mums Podcast Facebook community. Everything you do matters and helps to spread the word about what neurodiversity in females looks like.